Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is a repeat guest on the podcast, but not from the main feed, Sarah Elkins, and we are going to be discussing Paladin of Souls by Lois McMaster Bujold, which was the 2004 winner of the Hugo Award for Best Novel. Hey, Sarah, nice to see you again.
Hey, nice to be here.
Talk to you again. Nobody else is seeing this, but you and I can see each other.
That's right.
It is always fun to chat with somebody that I'm already comfortable with. It's a barrier that doesn't have to be broken down. So it's cool.
Sure.
And you know, on that note, listeners to the podcast or to the panel discussions that we've done on various things, including Lady Hawk, will already know you, but I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about your background relevant to this discussion.
Sure. So, hi, I'm Sarah Elkins. I've been active in fandom since my teens, and I've been reading science fiction and fantasy since maybe before my teens. Growing up, I read a lot of science fiction and pulp adventure stories from my father's bookshelves, from Edgar Rice Burroughs to Cordwainer Smith, Larry Niven, lots of different authors in many bookshelves in my parents' house. So we didn't pay much attention to Hugo Awards back then, just didn't follow the award stuff at all. But I tallied it up, and I've read about 35 now of the best novels and the winners. And I've been nominating and voting for most categories of the Hugos for the last few years.
Cool. Well, and that makes sense for that made you a good participant for the panel discussions that we've had.
Right.
Because that's kind of an outgrowth of me finally nominating and voting in the Hugos.
Right. So. Well, there's so much interesting work beyond the best novel category. I certainly enjoy reading the novels, but there's a lot of good work out there in the other categories, too.
Yeah, there definitely is. We've been talking about what book to cover for a while, and at some point you had offered to switch, but there was a particular reason you wanted to cover this one. So do you want to talk about why this book?
Right. So Paladin of Souls, I love this book. I got it in hardback as soon as it was available. I'd been reading Bujold from her science fiction and followed her into her fantasy. I had read the precursor to this book, The Curse of Chalion. And this one pivots, though, to mostly different characters. I found the characters that are covered in this story really interesting. And their relationships and their thoughts and struggles are a fair bit different in tone, at least, although some of the same ground maybe is covered. But I think it would work fairly well as a standalone for someone who hadn't read the first book in this Five Gods world. I would think, you know, for readers coming to it out of context, it ought to work fairly well because of the character pivot. There are some references to events in the past, which there are in so many historic fantasy where you've got, you know, hundreds of years ago, blah, 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 you know, so no more than those kind of books, I would say. This book has some history before the story starts, but I think the author handles it well. I've read it multiple times, and I read it again before our discussion and listened. I know, Seth, you often listen by audiobook. So from the library, I listened to some of the audiobook as well, just to kind of get an idea of what you would have been listening to with the narrator and so on.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because I started this one off on the audiobook, but it was one of those things where I requested the audiobook and it came through like right before Christmas. And so I just never got to it. and I only had like 4 days left and not much time to deal with it. So I really only got me through like the first four chapters in audio. And then I read the rest in print. And that was, kind of moving into overall thoughts about this. Mm-hmm. This is not my kind of book. I'm much more of a science fiction reader. Mm-hmm. I have not really read that much classic fantasy, kind of what you think of, you know, Lord of the Rings and that kind of thing. I've read a few of the sort of classics in that, but it's never been like a genre that I really, really love. There was a time where I was tracking my reading and I realized that I had read almost all fantasy that year because I had read the whole like the Heroes of Olympus and the Percy Jackson and the Olympians series in the same year, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the Prydain Chronicles, and a couple like young adult, more urban fantasy kind of things. So I do dabble in it, but it's not always been a genre that I really, really like. A few years ago, I did get the audiobook for The Curse of Chalion, because I knew eventually I would be getting to this book. And so memory wasn't super fresh about it going into reading this. And so I kind of, I didn't quite get the first, you know, the person who had went in completely cold experience. But, you know, a lot of the stuff with the theology of the five gods was, I had to relearn in this book. And of course, Bujold, it's not like Bujold has no experience writing books in series where she wants somebody to be able to enjoy it on its own.
Right.
Because the Vorkosigan saga is massive.
Right.
And she tries to make those so that they're readable as standalones. And so, yeah, I think this one probably works fairly well as a standalone. The only thing I had remembered about The Curse of Chalion is that there was a really interesting kind of finale to the book, because there was this prophecy of someone dying three times for something. And I kept going, well, how's he going to die a third time? Mm-hmm. You know, how's the math going to work on that? And so I remember enjoying it. And full disclosure, sorry, I've been monologuing a bit here. I really did like this one.
Oh, good.
I enjoyed it a great deal. It was a bit of a slog at the very beginning, and the audio really kind of helped me get over that hurdle, which was nice. Though I did go back and reread the parts that I covered on audio as well, just because I wanted to get more of a flavor of that. And like, okay, yeah, I can see why that was not totally working for me. Because it just, all of a sudden, I started reading it, and I was like, oh, look, another fantasy book about a person going from this place to this place.
Yes, fantasy books do often have road trips. And there's such
very
good
slow
mechanisms
road trips
for having things move along plot-wise and so on.
Yeah.
On what you were saying before about prophecies and what does this prophecy mean in the predecessor, that's also pretty common in going back to the Sibyls in Greek mythology. Yeah, what does this prophecy mean? You know, well, the sails are black. What does that mean? What was that prophecy really supposed to signify? And that's, I think, a common part of fantasy that deals with mythology, where you're trying to figure out, you know, I think they're trying to give me a message. What does it mean? And that's kind of a puzzle. And I agree, in the previous book, you were trying to figure that out. And that's in some ways true in this as well, because they're grappling with messages from gods. And what does that mean?
Yeah, but it was very satisfying in The Curse of Chalion. That's what I remember.
Yes.
I remember, okay, I was super pleased with the way that all wrapped up.
Yeah. Well, by now, Bujold really knows how to put things together, how to lay groundwork early that then has a rich reward later on in the book.
Yes. And, you know, she has a tendency to write very readable prose, right? And so even if it's fantasy, it's not dull. It's always interesting.
Right. So you were talking about how it starts a bit slow. And I agree, some readers are definitely going to find that experience. I think a lot of that has to do with, the character in the start of the book, the main character, Issa, has kind of turned herself off as much as possible to get through every day. And in the start of the book, she's gradually waking up a little bit, having new thoughts for the first time in years. And that can be a bit of a slog to get through. There's definitely some characters who are grappling with some issues in this book, and that's in some ways this book starts out a little grimmer and darker than some people may be expecting from some other of Bujold's work.
Well, and you know, in at least with my experience with fantasy, lots of times the protagonists are in their prime, you know, youngish. Mm-hmm. If you think about the Lord of the Rings, you know, Frodo is, I think, in his 40s by the time he sets out on the quest. But
they consider him still pretty young because the hobbits are long lived. So yes,
yeah, exactly. Where here you have a main character who's definitely middle aged,
right?
She has grown children. She has grown children. Yeah, well, and so that's interesting. That speaks to me. I have an adult son as well.
Right. So there are a lot of things going on in this book. One spoiler-free way I would recap it is a middle-aged queen mother goes on a road trip to escape annoying people and finds more than she was expecting. That's really spoiler free, but you know, the character Ista, that's kind of all you see of her to start. And then as the book goes on, you learn much more about her. And
she was a character in The Curse of Chalion, but she was, you know, God touched and considered mad. Right. And because of the curse, right?
Right. So people who read the first book would know a little bit about her, but this is so much more from her point of view. And you see a lot more of what her earlier story was really like beyond the gloss and high romance of, you know, she married the king, et cetera. Here you find out really what that was like. And it's not all rainbows. And
no, definitely not. And she had a hard time of it. And so I feel like there's something that I can also relate to in there with at the beginning of the book. She's been through all these tough times and now she's just had it.
Right.
And it's just like, I want to go do something for myself.
Right. Right.
And sets out and comes up with a story that she can tell when she gets, you know, essentially she tries to sneak off, right?
Right. She would like to just leave and she sets off ill prepared and that doesn't work out so well. But she comes up with an idea in her first attempt for how maybe she can really get away for at least a little while.
Turn it into a religious pilgrimage.
Yes. Yes. And that's not a bad idea on her part because the world of the five gods, this setting, there are a lot of people who are pretty serious about their religious vocations who do go on pilgrimages. And there are other people who just go on pilgrimages just because they want to be out on the road, maybe away from supervision for a little while.
And she had been kept for a long time, right?
Yes. Yes. She's seizing a chance to get away from the castle where she's been pretty much constrained for years and years and years. And so I think many readers who read her in the first few pages will have a sympathy for her getting away, you know, wanting to get away. There's paragraphs where her ladies in waiting are just endlessly chattering. And they've all gotten in the habit of, because Ista had been considered mad earlier, they've all gotten in the habit of kind of disregarding things she says and infantilizing her. And
right, assuming she's not capable.
Right, and how can she get away? And this pilgrimage is a way to get away. So just before we go too further with that, on the overview, Bujold's books often have lively characters, sometimes with ethical challenges. There are always some interesting relationships between the characters and funny bits. She definitely does humor very well, even in a book with a lot of grimness like this one, and good dialogue. She really writes characters who feel, you know, it feels like you're reading real people who are talking about things, and they have very different personalities from each other. So, this one does start slow, but the slowness is kind of Ista is just kind of bursting to get out of this slowness. Mm-hmm. And so it, in a way, it kind of kicks off the plot. Pretty soon some pretty exciting things start to happen with,
And to be fair, when I say it starts slow, it's a couple chapters.
It's not the first half of the book. She gets on the road pretty soon.
And encounters bandits, you know, and raiders and things. And it gets exciting from there. And she writes a battle scene really, really well.
She does.
And then she gets pulled into the mysteries of Poriphorus. And I really, really want to encourage people, if you haven't read this one, there's some great reveals in it.
I want to stay away from those reveals, you know, certainly until we get to the spoiler section. There are mysterious and magical goings on. I did want to talk some about the magic in this. You know, people may be saying, well, is this just another neo-feudal fantasy? Yes and no. One of the things that Bujold is grappling with in this whole this is part of the series, the Five Gods World series that also won Hugo for best series.
Right.
And I find the theology in this book really interesting, but I'll tell people it's not like you're trying to sit down and read David Hume or a very dry treatise. You know, it's getting into sort of mythology, world building, but the gods in this world are pretty present. To everyone, but it's very well known that gods really appear to people, really talk with them.
Right.
And the way that and the magic intersects in this book is also interesting. Mm-hmm. So just to explain to a little bit, there are four or five gods in this world, depending on how you count them. However you count them, they work through people. They can only work through people of those people's own free will. And I do want to talk more about free will later in our discussion, because that's a really pivotal topic in this book. Each god has an order devoted to their service. So you have the mother, the father, the daughter, the son, and the bastard. So each god is a little different in their focus. And for people who talk to them, you don't have to be perfect to do so, but you have to be really open to them.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, Seth, I was thinking about this is a little bit related to our Lady Hawk discussion that we discussed earlier, because in that book, in that movie, Mouse is not a perfect person. He's a thief, but he talks to God directly. Mm-hmm. He may not always be sure God is listening very attentively, but he does feel that he can talk to God. And in this book, there are orders, there are prayers, there are, religious authority figures, but it's also perfectly plausible for an individual if they're prepared and open, if they're not bound up in anger or resentment or other things that can distract people. And so she's getting at some interesting thoughts about religion, and not in a pages and pages of discourse way, but just in the way these characters are all relating to God and how they look at it. So that's one thing. You have the gods, and they can work their will only through people. Then there are also demons. And demons in this book, they're not necessarily evil. They're agents of chaos.
Right.
And depending on how they come into the world, they can come into animals or people without their consent. But it kind of depends on, what experiences these forces have coming into the world. How are they shaped by the beings that they enter? And there's a lot to do with that in this book, and even more in some of her other books.
Right. It's fun too that that not everybody in this world accepts the same theology
of
the gods, right? Because you have the quadrine, they call them the quadrine heretics, right?
Right.
This neighboring country.
Right. I named five gods and they don't believe in the bastard as a god.
Right. Well, and even in the Quintarian religion, right? They understand that the bastard is the offspring of the mother and a demon.
Right.
A special one.
Right. One of the priests that we get to know in this book, or a brother, Dicabon, talks about there are actually some different ideas about exactly how that happened.
Exactly.
The demons can cause a lot of problems in the world. And some orders, the bastard's order, works to contain and direct the chaos of the demons. So, as far as the mythology in this book, most of the evil comes from people. They don't view the demons as evil, although the quadrines, which is the sect, the group nations that only believe in four gods view the Quintarians, the believers in five, as heretics. Again, it's coming from people, and so you don't have a great dark evil in this fantasy series, unlike some others like The Dark is Rising, you know, just recently from Christmas and so on. So, and for me, that works a little better for reading a fantasy along those lines.
And in many ways, it's similar to the Greek gods, and that they're a little aloof. Mm-hmm. Definitely capricious, and some of the things that they do through people, the people are convenient to them,
right?
It's useful to the gods to do something,
right?
And therefore, I'm going to come through you, and yes, you have technically free will about it, but I might make your life miserable if you don't do what I want.
Right, sending dream after dream after dream.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. The gods have their intentions, and mm-hmm. and. That's not always how ordinary people are going to be looking at what needs to happen.
Yeah. The Quadrine versus Quintarian thing reminds me a little bit of just like Christianity and Islam and Judaism. Mm-hmm. All define themselves as monotheists, but non-Trinitarian religions look at Christianity and go, you sure you have one God?
Right. Right. So. Right. And certainly someone could look at the gods in this world and say, well, aren't they all just different aspects? But that's not at all how sure. these people on this world look at it, at least not the people who are active characters in the book. So going back to the title, Paladin of Souls. So one common way to play paladins in Dungeons & Dragons is as rigid, unyielding, self-righteous, holy warriors. I've been in a D&D campaign with one of those paladins, and boy, they make it really awkward to try and have a good adventure. you know, they can also be incredibly noble and generous and giving, often with healing powers. Don't think of that when you think of this book, because here instead, what you have is Ista. And she, the queen mother on the run, i.e. pilgrimage that I mentioned before. And she is the Dowager Royina of Chalion. She's Chalion. She's the mother of the woman who is now the queen. And she's mad at the gods for events mm-hmm. in the past. She's guilty over a fatal mistake she made back in the past out of panic and fear for her children, but it was a fatal mistake. And she's just had it, like you said, Seth. She's had it. She doesn't want to go pray. She doesn't really want to hear anything more about the gods, although she knows she's going on a pilgrimage. So she knows she's going to have to hear some more, but she's hoping to not. Yeah, she's the pilgrimage is her only way out of the castle. So that's what she's doing. So she's maybe not someone everyone might definitely think of for a choice for a paladin, in addition to being, you know, a middle-aged woman with no sword training, et cetera, et cetera. But the thing about paladins is they're usually sworn to working, at least in D&D, they're usually sworn to or working with a particular god. I know there were paladins before D&D, but that was really my reference to them. I mean, they've been in fiction, you know, longer than before there was D&D, but but they're usually sworn to a specific god in D&D, and different gods, may have different focuses, priorities. You were mentioning in this book, gods are kind of using people and not always caring a lot about what that person wanted. Ista is completely aware of this due to, you know, her previous experience. You know, she refers to the gods as chewing people up and spitting them out. She is bitter. She is not eager to be in service to gods again. And so the whole thing about paladins, you know, it has which god they're with has an effect on what they do and how they do it. And that's relevant for things, how things work for Ista that this time. Last time she was the gods can call different people to service, and people don't always succeed at those tasks. Sometimes they turn away and so on, or sometimes they try and fail. I mentioned Ista's previous panic, born of panic and fear. That's when she was trying to work with the mother goddess. And things are different in this book. A different god starts working with her. He has a little bit more of a sense of humor that kind of works well with the gallows humor that she's kind of developed over her life.
He's got a sick sense of humor.
Yes, he does. it's fun. And the thing is, although Ista has been so worn down by a lot of her life, she, you know, as she's on the road, she kind of uncoils a bit of herself, and you see that actually she has kind of a mischievous sense of humor. You know, she is not a reverent person. You know, she is irreverent, and actually that works pretty well with the bastard that she starts working with.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, along the way, she comes in contact with Liz, who becomes sort of her handmaiden, though she's very much the working class handmaiden.
Right.
And she's a terrific character as
well. I love Liz. Yes.
Liz is fantastic.
Yeah. So the people who have been her keepers try to make her pilgrimage into this big pageant. And boy, Ista does not want that. She wants to go on the road with a few people and just lead a simple life and just be away from the castle and not have to have her hair done in elaborate coils every time. And, they keep braiding her hair so tight that it gives her a headache, and she doesn't want that. And Liz is someone that she lights on to help her kind of break, you know, the kind of life that she's been in and have something a little more relaxed on the road.
Yeah. Practical.
Yeah. So there is more. I did want to talk about some of the other things like free will, but I think that might lead us into spoilers category.
We've been going long enough on non-spoilers. We didn't really talk about comps for it. There's an element here that's a little spoilery that it reminds me of the picture of Dorian Gray. I think you had some comps written down, yeah?
I did. So I'll be interested to hear about the Dorian Gray, but for me, I had four. An obvious one is Geoffrey Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales, where a bunch of people go on a pilgrimage, it has a bunch of bawdy tales in it. These are not your most reverent people on a pilgrimage, the one that Geoffrey Chaucer talks about, and they tell each other stories as they go on the road, and some of the stories are bawdy. And that actually kind of lines up with some of the stuff in this book. Now, this book isn't over the top. This is not a bodice ripper. it's not that kind of body, but these people are very aware of real life and real bodies. And I mentioned Ista's and the bastard's sense of humor. I also would talk about Charlotte Perkins Gilman's The Yellow Wallpaper. That's a classic horror story about a woman whose husband and doctor basically don't recognize what she's dealing with, decide she's going crazy, and that the best way to deal with her is to keep her locked up in this room, which has this yellow wallpaper that is creepy. And so in the story, reading the story, you're not quite sure. Well, is she crazy? Is her husband right? Is the wallpaper haunted? Or is she just some poor young woman who is being trapped by people who think they know best? And that's very relevant to the first part of this book. Now, the yellow wallpaper can be a tough read. So can this one. As you read more about in the book, it turns out that earlier in her life, Ista was gaslighted by her husband and her husband's best friend. And, you know, so there's definitely, for some people, that will read as horror. Absolutely. Yeah. People who can put themselves in the shoes of that kind of situation. So I would say, you know, that reminded me a lot of the yellow wallpaper. We were talking about paladins. Elizabeth Moon's Paxinarian series does have, as a paladin, someone who does a lot of sword fighting, which is not what Ista does. But it starts off with a woman on, she's a sheep farmer's daughter. That's the first book in the series. And she goes on the road to be of service somehow, and gets in over her head and bad things happen. And she also, well, I guess this is a spoiler for that, but she kind of becomes a saint. And the paths that Paxinarian and Ista are taking are very different, but they are both struggling with people who think they know what the right way to be a saint is. And they are, you know, trying to actually pay attention to what they think their God is telling them and not so much to what other people are telling them the right way to be is. And then the only other one I'd bring up right now is Joe Graham has written some historical fantasies with humans' interactions with gods, starting with Lost Souls. That's a book about a Trojan priestess who maybe doesn't come from quite the right background, but is trying to listen to what her Lady of the Dead is telling her. And she also falls in with a bunch of soldiers who are on the run and trying to figure out something for themselves. So I would say that this book falls really well in with any of those books. So I would say if you're interested in those books, you'll be interested in this book and vice versa. If you like these, if you read this and like it, I think you might want to look at the other books that I just mentioned.
Okay. Okay, cool. I mean, I'll add them to my list as well, just because since I've been so focused more on science fiction for so long and uneducated in fantasy, there's no reason to think that a book like this couldn't become my type of book.
Sure. I'll mention, of the ones that I mentioned, The Yellow Wallpaper is a short read. It's only a few short, horrible pages.
Okay. All right, sounds fun. I definitely prefer my horrible pages in smaller groups.
Right.
Let's go ahead and jump over into spoilers.
Okay.
And I want to start, I want to make a comment here that is not too spoiler heavy, just to give people a chance to find the button and, and skip to the next episode if they want.
Sure.
Normally in a particularly like superhero television and movies, right? Smallville or any other places, I'm really impatient with people concealing a gift that they have. Because normally it doesn't serve anything other than just to keep the tension up, right? The dramatic tension. And I can't really justify for the character to do it. But in this case, you know, she has this second sight, and you can completely understand with her background, her not wanting to tell anyone about it because for fear of being considered mad again. Even though, of course, you know, they live in this area where they have the theology of the five gods. And so there's no reason to think that someone who says the gods have been talking to me isn't crazy, right? If somebody said that today to one of us, we'd go, well, okay, let's find you a padded room or some, you know, some drugs or
something.
But
it's so common in her, I mean, it's not every person, you know, it's not every day common, but it's absolutely not unknown. And that's part of what's so heartbreaking about, you know, her own mother dismisses her as you know, over-dramatizing. It's, you know, she's got reasons to be bitter and angry. She absolutely does. And, I would happily geek with you about Smallville and the secrecy there that is a plot device. And I could happily chat about that. But yeah, in this book, she has reasons to be rejecting things.
There is a real risk that if she talked to someone frankly about her second sight and her abilities, that she would just be, you know, put back in the box.
Right, right.
It kind of reminds me of when you, I've seen YouTube's about medical reporting and the way women and particularly women of color are treated in medical settings, where they're assumed to be exaggerating their symptoms.
That's right.
And which is just shocking to me.
Right. I used to work at National Cancer Institute and have read papers about disparate medical treatments and analyses and diagnoses depending on, you know, gender and color. And yes, I mean, I'm lucky in some ways that I'm a white woman, you know, because at least some people will listen to me some of the time. But That's definitely a thing. And this book doesn't really get into gender politics as such. It's just you're living in it, you know. So, but there's no diatribes in this book. It you know.
Right, but nobody else in her family was considered mad.
It's
even though they went through similar things.
Right, right. I mean, I think it's there if you're paying attention, but it's not lectured in the book.
Agreed.
Yeah. This book has depth to it for sure, and I think that may be one reason why it got a Hugo and the first one didn't, maybe because there are some more serious things going on. I mean, you could also look at, you know, which books was each competing against and how that worked and so on. There's multiple reasons. So let me give a little bit more to listeners about what actually happens in this book.
Yes.
So she goes on a pilgrimage. She's, as I mentioned, she's trying to pick people to go with her that are going to be fun and lighthearted and not all, oh no, Ista, you must wear the purple slippers, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And it turns out that there's an invasion from another company, a country. Mm-hmm. And so they have to deal with a lot of unpleasant things. And so they take refuge in another castle. They left one castle. They've been traveling across the country, having a few nice pilgrimage adventures, stopping in this town and that temple and so on.
You get the one church service where Dickabone gets to do his explanation of the five gods for the new reader.
Which is very handy for us, yes. but so they wind up in this other castle that's led by two half-brothers, one of whom
is apparently gravely ill.
Is apparently gravely ill, and the other of whom is not apparently gravely ill to most eyes. Yes. And
it's such a good mystery.
Oh, yeah, it really is. The castle is besieged by more of the people who had attacked their pilgrimage party to begin with. Ista also has some clashes with the lady of the castle, the one married to the brother who's, you know, the legitimate Lord of the Castle.
He's the March, right? The March of Poraforce.
Yes. And so, you know, being besieged by this other country, it turns out there's a whole lot of sorcery going on in and out of the castle. There are a lot of struggles, and Ista starts talking to the bastard more because he's talking to her, and she's seeing things before her that she, you know, she was brought up to have some sense of duty, and she feels like she has to do things, you know, to help A, her friends, and B, her country, she's you know, as reluctant and betrayed by her past, you know, that she was. She's got a strong sense of setting things right. She's come awake, and she sees there's work set before her.
Well, and she starts to see the upside of her God touch status.
Right. Well, there's things she needs to do, and she has to open herself back up to the God's vision that he's allowed to, or that he's graced her with.
Yeah, but it's such a good moment when she turns and says, "So, Lord Arhais, how long have you been dead?"
Oh, that's great! Yes,
it's so good.
She's got a great sense of humor, and she thinks she solved the riddle of why did the god kiss her forehead in her vision, and so she kisses a couple of people thinking that she's about to do something with that kiss. And then it's just kind of each time it's just a kiss. And so then she has to resort to, all right, I guess I still have to figure out what's going on here and what is it I am supposed to do? And can't you people just tell me? And, you know,
just trying to get people to tell her the truth.
Right.
She kind of has to do all the, it's almost like a detective story.
Yeah.
Because she has to, kind of collude with Lys to distract mm-hmm. Lady Catalara, you know, to get her out of the castle.
Right. The Lady of the Castle does not want this mystery solved because she's
yes.
pretty much in denial. Catalara is in denial about everything that's going on right now. None yes. of it, of course, is Catalara's fault from Catalara's point of view.
Right. Well, I mean, she was a victim and she's just leaning into that
and
still trying to. It's over, right?
Right.
There's no happy ending to the way she's doing it, right? Everybody's going to die.
Right. And one of the things that Ista says to Catalara during the book is, you are married to a commander, a lord and commander of an area. You grew up the daughter of another lord and commander. You cannot possibly have been brought up to this wild self-indulgence. You know, and right. I know from Catalara's point of view, this is also unfair. And mm-hmm. Anista does point out that lots of people have unfair things happen to them.
And she knows better than most.
Yeah.
So this is where the picture of Dorian Gray kind of comes into it.
Because you have
Arhys going out onto the field of battle and taking a wound that doesn't affect him.
Right.
It affects, what is his brother's name? Ilvin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It affects him or whoever he's tethered to through the magic, who's kind of taking that wound for him temporarily while he's still being kept alive.
Right.
The only difference is in the picture of Dorian Gray, it's all moral wounds.
Right.
Here it's physical.
Right. And I've certainly seen a lot of meme treatments of the picture of Dorian Gray at times. Yes, that's kind of what this magic is. Because of one of the demons that's involved here, those wounds kind of travel sympathetically to the other people instead of Lord Arhys. Arhys.
Arhys was the way the audiobook said it.
Okay,
so
thank
that's,
you.
That's what I'm going with.
So I did look up Chalion to make sure I had that one right.
Yes.
but those wounds that his brother Ilvin gets, for instance, for part of the book, are not of Ilvin's will. I did want to circle back on the free will topic. It's really important in this book, and not just a matter of the gods and their creations, though that's mm-hmm. certainly, the context that I'm most familiar in general. But this book also has what you could call free will topics coming up over and over in families in this story. Mm. So Ista's family protects her almost to the point of her madness. They almost mm-hmm. drive her mad by protecting and swaddling and like not letting her take two steps without running after her. And oh my lady, this is, very dangerous and so on and so on. The brothers later in the book try to protect Catalara from the chance to do something meaningful and dangerous, and there's a whole lot of people protecting people for their own good, which somewhat takes away from free will. And, contrastingly, there's examples in the book of, Lys, when Ista early in the book asks, well, how did you get your parents' permission? And Lys says, I kind of forgot to ask them. Lys, to explain a little more, is a royal courier, and she's very good on a horse, on a fast horse. Mm-hmm. She loves to ride and get away from trouble. She can generally ride away from any trouble she encounters.
And she's a bit of a show off.
She's a bit of a show off. and she's, but she's very merry. She's not a jokester. She's actually pretty quiet most of the time. And that's mm-hmm. one thing. She's kind of a relief for Ista to be around because she's not always talking at her and, my lady-ing. But nonetheless, a merry person, a happy person. But back on, the gods, the bastard is a really good lineup for Ista because he has the sense to know that what she needs is something to do. When she asks, what can the gods possibly, look, you killed my son, you know, is an accusation she levels, fairly or not. Mm-hmm. But and she says, what can you possibly offer me that can tempt me to work with you? And the bastard says, work.
Right.
Which, you know, if you're someone who's been told for the last 15 or more years that you're mad and useless and just have to be this pampered thing on a throne or, you know, mm-hmm. in a room, boy, that can sound pretty enticing. And it does sound, it does attract Ista that she could do something.
Yeah.
But it's still a choice, you know, and it takes Ista quite a while to mm-hmm. be ready for that choice.
Yeah. I had a question that I was hoping you would be able to mm-hmm. to answer for me, just for the world of five gods and especially the Curse of Chalion. Mm-hmm. Did any of the stuff about the father of both Arhys and Ilvin,
yes,
who had died, you know, died through tragic circumstances, mm-hmm. is that mentioned in Chalion or is that only in this book?
I think it is when Khazariel meets Ista. So Khazariel is the protagonist, for those who haven't read it, of right. the Curse of Chalion. And he meets Ista at one point, and he has heard some. And I think he may have heard about the rumor about what happened to the two half-brothers' father. Or, okay. Well, that's not saying it quite right. But anyway, he's heard enough. That may not be something he directly asks her about. He certainly knows that she's been accused of being mad, but since he can see ghosts and is somewhat God's touched as well, he's one of the few mm-hmm. people who's actually talked to her who says, oh, she's not crazy. Yeah. She's just kind of like me.
Yeah. Well, and the story, you know, as it unfolds here mm-hmm. is you find out that it's the peril of trying to interpret the prophecy.
Yes.
And make the prophecy happen because they think, oh, well, someone's got to die three times for us. So let's drown them, resuscitate, drown, and this curse will be broken.
It's not the worst possible interpretation. I mean, they're at least trying to make sense of it. But they are impatient and they panic.
Yes.
And things go very badly. And Ista thinks about that a lot during the book and thinks about, how could things have been different? Maybe if they had waited and let someone rebuild their courage, maybe they could mm-hmm. have tried it again. Or maybe, you know, she comes up with other ideas in the book of maybe how things could have gone differently. But, you know, that chance is gone, but she still has some chance to do some things.
Right. I had written down a quote from Ilvin, and I can't remember if it was when she was telling him about attempting to, you know, work the miracle mm-hmm. of lifting the curse. And he says to her, most people fail to work miracles most of the time.
Yes. Yes. She confesses her sin a few times and it finally starts getting easier for her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's had this guilt bottled up, guilt and rage bottled up for so long. And finally talking about it several times for particular reasons is part of, I think, what helps kind of ease the logjam in her. I have a couple of quotes too.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So early in the book, this is Ista. She decided to return straight speech for straight speech. It was rare enough in a Rowena's hearing and ought to be encouraged. So this is where, you know, someone asks her something pretty blunt and
right.
You know, she's kind of taken aback, but she has the sense to know it's really not good to only surround yourself with flatterers. Especially if you're a powerful person, really, especially then. And that's a parallel with something that's made more of. This is kind of a remark in passing in this book, in Bujold's The Hallowed Hunt, which is another Five Gods novel. That's a much bigger plot element. So I just thought that was interesting on this reread to come across that. And then later in the book, Ista says, you cannot push the darkness back with reason. You have to use fire. Literally, that's true. If you're sitting in the dark, you know, fire or electricity to make light or something along the lines of that. And I certainly know, Yeah, I was brought up with a lot of emphasis on reason and logic. I know that I still have the impulse to say, look, if I just explain it so they can understand right. it, you know, but that's just not always how it works.
No, so, you know, no, the backfire effect is very, very well documented at this point, right?
Yeah, yeah. So two quotes that I just found of note when I was mm-hmm. rereading it. On the topic of people thinking how other people should be dealing with these big life challenges. You know, this is how you should deal with the gods. You know, mm-hmm. one of the things, this book does have romance in it. So there is kissing stuff in this book, but it's pretty late in the book. It's not that bad. Despite it having some romance, it has a very sharp take on people who romanticize other people's challenges. So yes. early in the book, Decabant, the learned brother who's sent to be their spiritual guide on the pilgrimage, you know, he keeps urging Ista to do things that he has no real concept of their impact. You know, he's got all these ideas about how wonderful it is to be God touched. And Ista is like, boy, you have no idea.
Yeah. Well, he wants it, but he doesn't know what he wants.
Right. Yeah. Right. And he's sincere in wanting it, but he just, you know, doesn't understand, you know, in this book, when Ista encounters a god, yes, she and the bastard develop a little bit of a, I wouldn't quite call it repartee. It's not that casual, but a little bit of a relationship where there's a little give and take, but meeting gods in this world is not like meeting a Greek god in the old stories. It is meeting an overwhelming presence. And often what they want of you is not going to be easy. It is not going to be fun. So that's one kind of romanticism. And then also Arhis, the lord of the castle, and Catalara each have romantic takes on this jumbled up idea of tragic love that they think is what Ista's past is. And that's so far from what Ista actually had to go through. And yet they've got these kind of starry-eyed ideas about, you know, what things were like for her. And I would say that Bujold is, you know, she doesn't have a lot of patience with people who romanticize tough things. In one of her science fiction books, one character is criticizing his father for being in love with the romance of tough choices. You know, I'm the tough guy who'll, I don't know, let the sick person fall behind so the zombies can get them. That's not in the Bujold book. But, you know, the romance of the tough choices of, you know, I'm the tough person who makes this cold, hard decision. You know, Bujold is really not all in on, you know, she's in on romance and love, but not in kind of dewy-eyed romance that just wants to look at everything through rose-colored glasses.
It actually reminds me of a moment in a very funny movie, Men in Black, where Jay starts to find out about Kay's past, and he finds out that he's got this tragic romantic history, right? And he says, "Oh well, you know, it is better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all." And Tommy Lee Jones, as Kay, just kind of leans over and says, "Try it." And I think yes, the voice of experience is going to beat the romantic notion.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Go ahead.
I just wanted to pick up on the kind of romance angle. And I feel like it's nice and subtle. And I really like the relationship between Ilvin and Ista is very organic, right? It's just logical. They're spending this time together and really knowing each other quite intimately over that time. I like the fact that Ilvin isn't pushy about it.
Right.
It just essentially is at some point he's just like, I mean, I'm right here. So as soon as you're ready. And he says to her, because she at some point in this book kind of has this sense of the greater purpose and that, you know, no, we're not going to live through this. There's no point in making future plans and that kind of thing. And he says to her at some point, time is where you take it. It will not linger for you. So saying you, at some point, you know, you have to make the decision for yourself and you have to embrace now. Because you cannot guarantee that you get it later. I say this to my son sometimes, usually like in the realm of financial planning and that kind of stuff. I tell him, you can't get the years back. or even with interpersonal stuff, right? Mm-hmm. If you think, I can talk to her later. I can approach her, after I graduate from college or whatever. And no, you might want to. Now is guaranteed, but future is not.
Right, right. In one of her other books, a character has this plan of when he's going to bring up the idea of dating to some other character. And she, having no idea of this, goes off and marries someone else. And he's like, but I had this plan. Maybe you should have said something. In this story, Ilvin, he approaches her in the middle of a battle, right, on the castle ramparts. And that's
and
his moment
dirty.
That he picks. Yeah, he's his mouth. He offers her some, hey, do you want some baked horse meat? And he's been munching on it,
Yes.
But he knows the moment is now. This may be it, and I don't want to have more regrets of chances I didn't take. So, and that's what he tells her. He's kind of working himself up to, gently. He doesn't like pounce on her, but gently, right, pulling her in for a kiss, and she lets him. His idea is this is it. Mm-hmm. Yes, maybe we'll die tonight or tomorrow, and I'm going to kiss you now because I can kiss you now. Let's kiss. Mm-hmm. And it's great.
He kind of had learned some lessons from watching his brother as well, because his brother was doing everything to please his father, right? It was never going to happen, right?
Right. He has a very clear view of what's going on with his brother. And fortunately, he loves his brother, and he has a little bit of a wry appreciation for the fact that women just keep parading right past him for his brother, his very dramatic and classically handsome and all of that. Brother, he's used to everyone kind of, but he also thinks his brother is kind of a fool for not looking. I mean, yes, his brother's married, but he thinks his brother ought to at least realize, wow, he's just pretty awesome, mm-hmm. And he sees that she's pretty awesome. And he kind of here's someone who's actually not falling for my glamorous brother. She's actually got a pretty good brain in there.
Yeah. Not that there wasn't a little bit there, right?
She was a little bit. Yeah.
Because this is the thing also of having these characters that are, mm-hmm. that are more middle-aged. Mm-hmm. Catalara is not middle-aged. She's younger.
Right.
And she's not Arhys's first wife.
Right.
And so there was stuff in there where it seemed like she was like, oh, hey, okay, this guy's very handsome and really good with a sword and
well, she's
quite
starting
dashing.
To wake up. She hasn't been thinking at all. When she was walled up in that other castle, there was no prospects, and she wasn't even thinking about it. The bastard is kind of waking her up to life and possibilities. She's having new thoughts. That's what sets her on the pilgrimage. She has a new thought. She wants the road. She's lived.
I really liked that when she said she wanted the road.
Yes.
That's early in the book.
That's in the first few pages of the book. She wants to be on the road, and she's really had quite enough of just being in a castle all her life. Go ahead.
I just wanted to pivot to talking a little bit about some of the battle scenes. Mm-hmm. They're very, very fun and very different than like things in the Vorkosigan saga, because those tend to be space battles.
Right.
Or battles with plasma arcs and stunners and things. And I did like that at some point when they head into a battle, Ilvin doesn't have a weapon at some point, and he sees an enemy rider coming towards him, and he says, ah, there's my sword.
Right. Yes.
I'm going to take it from that guy.
Absolutely. Yes, one of the things I like about her battles here is terrain is important. There are rivers and hills and ridges, and as opposed to in the space battles, where it's all pretty much space, terrain really matters. These besiegers are attacking the people in this castle. They're attacking them on their own ground. And mm-hmm. Arhys, the lord of the castle, he knows every inch of his territory. He is a good lord commander. He mm-hmm. studies his own terrain. He knows how to use his terrain effectively. And it is a pleasure to read someone who, not a military person herself, but at least knows the importance of that in land battles. It's huge.
Right.
And I like that that is a factor here, you know, when they're riding to get away from this or that. And that's one of the, there's a lot of specifics in her battle. Not just, you know, swords clanged.
Exactly.
There's strategy. You know, if you read, you see that at least she has a lot of sense of what that kind of strategy would be. And I definitely like that part of her. You know, there is a fair bit of fighting in this book. It starts out slow, but there are definitely some military actions in this book. Mm-hmm. So,
of course, the decisive battle is not sword play, right? It's the showdown between Ista and, I can't remember the
Joan.
Name. Joan?
Yes.
And it's such a great moment. It's the get away from her, you bitch moment from Aliens.
Yeah. So Princess Joan is the Rachnari ruler. That's the other country that's been invading them. Mm-hmm. And she has a lot of power. And she's kind of an interesting contrast to Ista in that Princess Joan is bound and determined to have satisfaction for a life of not being able to get her way. She's now acquired these powers, partly just through force of will, but she's got them. And she's doing things to her own family because she's so tired of being ignored. You know, she was the princess regent for a long time, and then her son attained majority, and she lost that regency power. And she's so frustrated that she starts turning to darker powers. And so she's also kind of a bitter, twisted woman. Ista was pretty bitter. But this one is so angry at everything that she can't let go of that. Women in this book are presented with different choices at different times that have to do with they haven't had agency. Here's a chance. What are you going to do? It happens with Catalara as well. She's faced with a difficult challenge later in the book. She makes one choice. Princess Joan is presented with a choice near the end of the book, and she makes a certain choice, and Ista is presented with choices over and over again, and how she deals with those choices evolves over that book. And I found that a really interesting part of the book. Bujold, I think, is definitely making some commentary on agency and choices in this book, how people who don't often have a lot of agency or aren't perceived that way, how they react when they suddenly get choices they didn't know they might get.
Well, and you were talking about the people who kind of do things at the behest of the gods and the openness. And there's also, I feel like, the vulnerability that Ista shows when she realizes, oh, I can just eat this demon, you know.
She's so inventive.
I can just swallow it.
I love it.
Yeah. And she does that, but then she has that moment where time sort of stops and she's interacting with the bastard and says to him, I'm not sure that I'm doing this right.
Right.
I'm not doing it perfectly. And he says, how fortunate for us that we thirst for glorious souls rather than faultless ones, or we should be parched indeed.
Right.
I think that's very cool.
Yeah. Getting back to the idea of perfection and not demanding it from earlier in the discussion. There are some great characters in this story, and the way they have relations with each other is complex, and it develops during the story. I definitely enjoy the way the relationship develops between Ilvan and Ista in very small little bites, because they don't have a lot of time. There's a lot going on. There are no big long rides in the countryside for a picnic for them.
Right.
No.
Exactly.
You know, they're trying to squeeze in, you know, a little bit of interest. But you know, that is part of what helps Ista stay rooted in this world. Because you know, there's that guy's pretty cute and he really wants me to stick around, you know, and I have not heard any hint that we're going to get another book about the adventures of Ista and Ilvin later in the book. You get some idea of what they're going to have, but I don't think we're actually going to get that book, but it's pleasant to think about.
Because I feel like she's had interactions with the mother and the bastard, and then a very short one in with the father.
Yes.
But nothing with the daughter yet, right? So
Her daughter in the first book does have direct interaction with the daughter, but is a servant of the daughter. And there is discussion about what that service, especially for a royalty figure or a potential royalty figure, what a big responsibility that is. The Hallowed Hunt is the book that deals a lot with the son. That book.
Oh yeah, I forgot about the son.
The different, whether you're looking at them as different gods or different aspects of gods, in this book, characters and in this world, characters are drawn to service to one god or another god. Yeah. I think partly depending on their personalities, what their position in life is, but also maybe just sort of affinities.
We didn't even talk about Foy and
Ferda.
Ferda
are the two brothers
who are servants of the daughter. Right,
servants of the daughter are sent with her, sent with Ista on her pilgrimage to her small pseudonymous pilgrimage, where she's not going as the Dowager she's going as, she's just a minor noble woman going on, but of course they send an escort with her, just not the big pageant that some people wanted her to go on. These two brothers, they have stuff going on too. One of them is really, really into horses. Can't stop talking about horses. So he has some interest in Lys, the courier rider. And Foix accidentally picks up a demon on the way. He's kind of more of a strategist. He has a more senior position in Order of the Daughter. We were talking earlier about the humor. There's definitely some brother humor going on in that.
Oh, big time.
And they're kind of all interested in Lys, who's this bright, fun, young, kind of patriotic may not be the right word, but she does love her royal courier job and wants to be good at it and give service. And so there's definitely some delightful characters in this story interacting with each other.
I'd definitely like to see further things because one of the brothers has picked up a demon and essentially become a sorcerer, which turns out doesn't make him evil. Right. And will now have to kind of undergo training and more or less be a servant of the bastard because of the demon.
Which is kind of not what he was planning, because he was in the service of the daughter. In this book, in this world, there are a couple of different ways to gain mastery over the demon. And one is through years of study. And that's generally what the orders do. Years of study to understand how to make this work and to kind of develop the mental discipline. And then other people just have a lot of force of will. And some of them have a lot of force of will because they're angry or because they're violently in love they have a lot of force of will because they're pretty good people. And here's this poor scared demon, and there's a lot of paths in this book. So I recommend it.
Yeah. Yeah, we should probably wrap up at some point. Goram is another interesting character because you find out that his soul is sort of torn. And when Ista restores it, he has this moment of realizing who he was before everything that happened to him, because he's become this, friend and servant of
Ilvin. Ilvin picked him up as a slave in a town.
Yeah.
And
and freed him, and he wanted to stay on.
Right. And then he realizes, I used to be a real jerk. when he finally gets his memories back. And he's kind of ashamed of who he used to be and kind of misses being Simple Gorham, the groom. And now he's got a lot of his mental stuff back. And, you know, maybe now he needs more responsibilities, but he kind of misses.
And he kind of comments to Ista, right? I'm too old to really make a new start. And she says, you have more time than all these dead people do.
Right.
So get over yourself.
Right.
And it's very practical. And I was just like, yes.
Ista has a lot of get over yourself isms to other people. She doesn't always say them out loud, but you know, she's honed. She's had to deal a lot with courtly, polite speech, and she's kind of done with that.
Yeah, it kind of it almost reminds me of what I'll tell my son sometimes, you know, when we compete in some way. I'm like, nope, the old man strength wins that one. And you know, he's 4 inches taller than me, he's extremely fit, and it boggles his mind how I can be stronger than him in some things. And I tell him, it's just, you live long enough in your body, you know what your body can do. And so, like, I know when I can push myself to hold at 90% for as long as I need to. And it's just the kind of thing that comes with age. It's, you know, muscle memory kind of thing. And I feel like there's something here with Ista as well, where it's the wisdom of having been through it.
One of the things that she talks about is persistence. The gods are, in their own way, amazed at physical reality and the persistence of human beings. In the previous book, there's a thing where Kazariel picks up a pebble after he's been through this big god experience. And he's like, wow, this pebble is amazing. You know, it just lasts and lasts and lasts. And Ista realizes that one of the reasons, and the bastard pretty much says as much later, one of the reasons the gods are coming to her is she persists. She has some self-destructive thoughts, but she chooses the road instead. And she keeps going on, even when she's tired and injured. And, you know, she's really good at focus on priorities and at persisting. And the bastard mentions to her later, you know, she says, you didn't abandon me. And he says, I notice you didn't abandon me. And that you know, that kind of persistence is, I think, I mean, yes, there can be young people who just don't know any better and persist anyway. That's a kind of a luck. But I think, you know, enduring is something that you know, I mean, it may be partly survivor's bias, but, you know, older people have sometimes developed that kind of ability to persist.
If they weren't tough, they wouldn't still be here.
That's right.
But let's go ahead and just move into final thoughts on this one. I'll just say that, like I mentioned at the top, it's not necessarily the kind of book that I would be like, this is my kind of book. But I got to the end of it and was like, okay, is there another one of these? Because I'd really like the further adventures. And I'm not sure I'll go back and pick up The Hallowed Hunt, because I know it's hundreds of years earlier.
It is kind of a prequel. There's stuff I like about that, but it is in its own way also a tough read. Her other books with Penric that are also in the Five Gods world, this is a young man who picks up his own demon, and he has a lot of adventures, and it's a lighter read. And most of those are shorts and novellas. You might enjoy dipping into some of those.
Yeah. Maybe I'll do that. That'd be fun. But I did enjoy this one. So I want to thank you for picking it.
Yeah. I find this book very satisfying.
That's a good word for it. Yeah.
There's a lot of developments in it that are very satisfying, and you have to work to get there. Ista has to work to get there. And I found that satisfying in the book for sure. I mentioned I've read it several times, so, and sometimes I'll just dip into one part or another, but you know, reading it straight through again was really a good experience. So
All right, well, Sarah, this was an absolute pleasure. It's always great talking to you, so thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the discussion.
Yep, I'm sure we'll talk again.
Okay,
all right, bye. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Sarah. I thought that was a lot of fun. Sarah is somebody you've heard here a number of times if you've listened to all the episodes that I've posted, especially the panel discussions and that kind of stuff, but always a pleasure to talk to. I do want to let you know that I only have a couple of these episodes left in the main project that I set out to do. I'm just going to go ahead and read through them here to try and attract anybody if they want to reach out. So Shadow Over Mars by Lee Brackett is one of them, The Wanderer by Fritz Leiber, and I think the only other one is A Desolation Called Peace. So just three unclaimed titles on the list. So if you want to get in for one of those or suggest somebody to be a guest on that, reach out to me, feedback@hugospodcast.com or tweet at me @hugospodcast. So thank you so much for listening. I want to remind you, I do have another podcast, Take Me to Your Reader. It's a fun podcast I do with two of my friends. We've been doing it for almost 10 years. I guess it's almost 9 years, really. But, you know, there's 125 episodes there if you're interested in adapted science fiction, and it's not always science fiction, not always adapted, to be honest, but it is a fun podcast. I also have Brief and Not So Brief, and there is a separate feed for that, although if you subscribe to the RSS feed for just hugospodcast.com, then you'll get those episodes as well. I think I'm planning on doing an Oscar predictions/opinions episode with Ethan and with my nephew Peter, so look out for that. We didn't do it last year, but this year I've been able to watch a few more of the movies, and so we might actually get that done. If you would like to support the podcast, of course, you can go and leave a rating or a review wherever you listen to the podcast. You can support financially by going to patreon.com/hugospodcast, and you can sign up there. I occasionally do exclusively patron stuff, but you also get things earlier there. At the very least, as soon as I have them edited, I drop them in the patron. And I think that will do it for this episode. So thank you again so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.